And as Andrea just noted, high on the agenda of many Republicans is a repeal of the health care law passed by the last Congress. We're going to step back from the scene in Washington now to look at where things stand with implementing that law. Alan Weil is the executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. He joined us to take stock of what's going on at the state level.
States are at the absolute heart of implementing the new health care law. Timelines are tight, even though many of the provisions don't actually take effect until 2014. If they can have a productive discussion and debate in 2011, they can set the course and meet the timelines. If they're stuck, either because of political battles or ideological divisions that they can't overcome, they're going to find themselves in a very tough position trying to catch up in the next couple of years, getting done what has to be done to implement the law.
A major provision of the law involves healthcare exchanges. States are designing their own. What is there to know about those exchanges?
Health insurance exchanges create a marketplace where consumers, whether it's individuals or small businesses, can come and see a set of coverage options. They'll have tools to compare them on price, on benefits, on quality. It's a marketplace that's designed to function more efficiently with more information, more transparency than anything we have today. The second role that the exchange performs is to be the conduit for federal tax credits that are designed to reduce the cost of insurance for people who don't have coverage through their job. So if your employer does not offer coverage, you can come to the exchange, you have the choices of plans that anyone would have, but you also will be able to obtain a federal tax credit that will reduce the cost of that coverage.
And what is the range of things states could be doing? And in fact, from what you know, give us some examples of what they are starting to do.
We should expect a pretty broad range of state approaches. The federal law is quite broad, and so states can either adopt what is often termed as a highly regulatory or aggressive purchaser model, where they actually negotiate prices with plans. They exclude plans that they feel are not offering the value or the product that the state feels is appropriate to sell. At the other extreme, we would expect to see some states take all comers. If a plan is licensed to offer products in that state and they offer products within the broad parameters of what the federal law requires, they can sell their wares on the exchange. It's a less regulatory approach at the state level, and I think we should expect to see everything from one end to the other to many in between.
Could you give a specific example of each of those versions?
Many people refer to Utah now as a model for a free market exchange. They set this up prior to enactment of the federal law, so it doesn't do everything that an exchange has to do under the new law. But its general approach is to create an open door for insurance plans. There's no regulatory role for the exchange. They're simply passing on whatever the insurance companies offer to the consumers who want to buy them. Massachusetts is often held up as the other end of the spectrum, if you will. They are more active in how they select the insurance plans that can participate in their insurance exchange. They negotiate over rates. They are more structured in terms of the benefit design. They have data and reporting expectations that purchasers might demand, but that in a Utah model are not expected of the plans. So those are not necessarily the bookends, but those are the two real-world examples that people tend to point to show the two different approaches.
Well, do you think the law is as politicized at the state level as it has been at the national level?
The law is as politicized at the state level as it is at the federal level, which is not often the case. But there's more motivation and I think more trust and more goodwill that lets you move from that ideological and political disagreement to actually developing policies that help the people in your state.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Alan Weil is the executive director of the nonpartisan National Academy for State Health Policy. And now a look at the evolving media Russian style. Last summer, Russia's president Dmitry Medvedev joined the tweeting masses with his own Twitter page called Kremlin Russia. And almost immediately, another Twitter feed appeared, Kremlin Russia. It's a satirical version whose faux presidential tweets are actually the work of two young Russians dubbed Masha and Sasha. With 58,000 followers and growing, it's a bit of a sensation on the Russian language web. Julia Yaffe, the Moscow correspondent for Foreign Policy magazine, wrote about Kremlin Russia for the latest issue. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
So which lines have you been finding the funniest?
The ones that just state the most simply just how greedy government officials are. For example, when a list surfaced in a Russian newspaper of all of the bureaucrats' children who have, at age 22, these very profitable businesses, Kremlin tweeted something like, "Local governors need to have more children so that we can have more successful young entrepreneurs."
When you imagine him sitting writing, Dmitry Medvedev, sitting in his office writing this, well, it adds to the absurdity, but it adds to the fun.
Absolutely. Medvedev's character is a little absurd. And I think the reason that a lot of these tweets are funny is that they are so blunt, and that really echoes the kind of brazenness with which everything is done, the brazenness with which government funds just disappear. Recently, they've discovered that the 1 kilometer of roads, which they're building in preparation for the 2014 Olympics, is the most expensive in the world.
And there's actually a tweet.
Yes, it goes something along the lines of, "In order to save 327 billion rubles, we've decided to move the Olympics to Vancouver, where everything is already ready."
You write that this Twitter feed is continuing a long tradition in Russia.
That's right. The most recent example of this is something called anekdoty. They're short canned jokes that were just kind of launched into society and were repeated over and over and over again. It was a way of sharing information and analysis when the media was completely controlled by the then Soviet state.
So a joke, one of those jokes would be what?
For example, you know, when Brezhnev was still in power, he and the ruling class, they were the octogenarians. They were extremely old. So one of the jokes was asking why one bureaucrat would go to meet foreign leaders at the airport, whereas one would wait at the Kremlin for them. And the answer was, well, this one operates on battery power and the other one plugs into the wall.
I do see similarities. Let me just ask you a kind of a straightforward question. Tweeting is often jaunty and light and certainly ironic. How much influence do you think it's really having?
It has a lot of influence because it's become a steam valve for a lot of the people who are the most active thinkers and readers and followers of the news, who follow the details of government corruption and ineptitude and who are deeply frustrated by it. There's a concept in Russian literature called laughing through tears. It's a very necessary comic relief because usually the system is very inert and very difficult to change, even by the people who ostensibly matter.
Julia Yaffe is the Moscow correspondent for Foreign Policy magazine. Her article on the Twitter feed Kremlin Russia is in the latest issue. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Renee.
The Kremlin won't say whether Medvedev follows the faux Twitter feed, but Masha and Sasha are certain he's aware of it and possibly influenced. The Russian president recently changed his Twitter account from Kremlin Russia to Medvedev Russia. U.S. car companies ended 2010 with such a strong finish, they're boosting their forecast for 2011. Here's Tracy Samilton of Michigan Radio.
Car sales in the U.S. showed some welcome signs of new life in December. Except for Toyota, still struggling from its recall crisis, car companies reported a significant boost in sales compared to the same month a year ago. Rebecca Lindland is an analyst with IHS Automotive. She lives and works in Boston.
There was a lot of concern, especially at the end there, that the East Coast would just be buried in our blizzard. But in fact, everyone dug out and they went to dealerships.
December was good to all three Detroit automakers. Ford sales were up an impressive 19% over the same month in 2009. Chrysler sales rose 16%. Sales were also up 16% for GM's remaining four brands. Lindland says domestic car companies no longer seem to be staring into the abyss.
The Detroit Big Three really, really came through 2010 far better than anybody expected.
The improvement means it's no longer crazy talk to shoot for car sales topping 13 million this year. The wild card will be a spike in gas prices, but even there, Detroit automakers are prepared. Ford has two new gas-sipping cars, the Fiesta and the Focus. GM has the Volt and the Cruze. Even Chrysler, or technically its Italian partner, will launch a minicar with great gas mileage, the Fiat 500. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn has become one of the most banned books in history, in part because of its frequent use of the N-word. Now one Twain scholar has come up with a solution. Use a different word. He hoped the new edition of Huck Finn would calm the controversy, but as NPR's Larry Abramson reports, it has just created more.
English professor Alan Gribben of Auburn University in Alabama says he came up with this idea while he was on a lecture tour trying to encourage schools to teach Twain.
Teachers would come up to me afterward and say, oh, I would love to use your remarks. I would love to get these books into my curriculum, but it's just not possible. The parents are so uncomfortable with them these days.
Because of the use of the N-word more than 200 times in Huck Finn. So for Gribben, this was a way to revive these books in the schools. Instead of the N-word, this alternative version refers to slaves. Here's what the new book would sound like, read by NPR producer Jim Wildman.
Slaves would come from all around there and give Jim anything they had just for a sight of that five centerpiece. But they wouldn't touch it, because the devil had had his hands on it.
Professor Alan Gribben says this is just an experiment to get past a word that has become such an emotional tripwire, a word that NPR reporters also avoid using on the air. But Gribben says instead of being hailed for resuscitating a banned book, he's gotten slammed.
It's just an avalanche of vitriolic emails.
I compared it to abstinence-only education for race.
Kai Wright attacked the update at colorlines.com, where he is editorial director. Wright says the revision actually shortchanges school children because it skirts the lessons they need to learn.
What does it mean both for society then, and what does it mean for society now? That's the kind of thing for a teacher to deal with. You can't really talk about race without talking about the ugly parts.
Perhaps Gribben should have known there would be a small rebellion when he laid his hands on Huck Finn, which Hemingway called the best book we've had. All American writing comes from that. Barbara Jones of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom says what Gribben has done is an act of censorship, which the ALA opposes.
To remove a word from a book is just a real insult to the authors wanting to, in this case, express how people spoke in that part of Missouri in the 19th century.
The new editions were originally intended for a limited print run of about 7,500 copies, directed mostly at schools and libraries. Of course, it's possible the outrage of the blogosphere will spark more sales. Professor Alan Gribben is undeterred by all the criticism. He says those emails have just demonstrated how much we need this book. He says even though they all argued for leaving the N-word in Huckleberry Finn, none would use the word itself. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
The YouTube video shot in your bedroom now has a slicker competitor, a homemade computer animated video made with something called Extra Normal. Nishat Kurwav, TurnstileNews.com, tracked down the people who made some of her favorite videos.
The video that put Extra Normal on the map has more than 10 million views on YouTube. Two button-nosed, Hello Kitty-like characters of indeterminate species confront each other in a static pastel scene with a lone cherry tree.
If it's not an iPhone, why would I want it?
The video takes a satirical jab at iPhone obsession. One of these beady-eyed creatures is plugging a rival smartphone brand.
Well, it's similar to an iPhone, but has a bigger screen.
I don't care.
The internet speeds are around 3 times faster.
I don't care.
It can grant up to 3 wishes, even if one of those wishes is for an iPhone.
I don't care.
With Extra Normal, anyone can make a computer-animated movie.
Create a presentation for school. Be the host of a talk show.
You hop on the site and choose a background and a couple of animated actors. To cast the irrational boss or the freaky neighbor, you can pick from Lego people, robots, or a gang of regular folks. A few celebrity characters are on hand for spoofs.
Be who you want to be. Be you.
You type in the script, add some basic facial expressions and gestures, and publish to the web. An Extra Normal chief technology officer, Silvio Druin, says, you could soon find that your video has inspired some competition.
People tend to come to our website to make a movie because they've watched another movie. We never invested one dollar in marketing.
Often, videos that hit the meme creation jackpot are bringing gripes before the court of public opinion.
Sisters, where are all the good black men? I just can't find one.
In this provocative short called Black Marriage Negotiations, the characters hash out tensions around black love and dating. A generic-looking black man and woman face off across a boardroom table. The woman rattles off a list of eyebrow-raising expectations, which include...
I want someone who earns six figures.
That's me.
A man who will pay all the bills, yet recognize I'm an independent woman.
What? How can you be independent when someone else pays all of your bills?
Daryl Lawson created the video to extend a conversation that began on his Philosophy's radio show. He figured animation could take the bite out of a contentious issue.
The pauses, the way he looks at the camera and him. So all of that lends to the comedic timing.
Even when you're writing something that's not really meant to be funny, say like this story, your video gets a humor boost from the computerized voice. An extra normal video can be shared more widely than a Facebook status update, requires less commitment than a blog, and packs more visual allure and nuance than a tweet. The most popular scripts have a formula. There's a wise guy who's the voice of reason and a tone-deaf argumentative partner. In this one, a professor levels with a student who's bent on applying to grad school.
You will teach 50 kids in one semester, while reading thousands of pages a week, and writing hundreds of pages for your jaded professors who are contemplating suicide daily. You will qualify for food stamps.
I will inspire students to think critically about literature.
Allison Leslie made this video instead of blogging about the frustrations of humanities studies.
Blogging can sometimes come across as ranting, and in this format, ranting turns into humor in a way that people can consume it in a positive way.
Extra Normal just hit the 2 million monthly user mark and adds about 7,000 new creators a day. For NPR News, I'm Nishat Kowa.
Hey, that story is from TurnstileNews.com, an online news service from Youth Radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Yesterday on this program, we heard a story from London about the boisterous world of British newspapers and how they, unlike their American counterparts, openly embrace a point of view. Today, NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik brings us an influential media critic who argues that mainstream American journalists do cling to their own ideology. It's not exactly on the right, not exactly on the left. He calls it the voice from nowhere.
What with websites and cable talk shows, it's hardly as though opinions are hard to come by in today's media landscape.
In exchange for selling out a principal campaign pledge and the people to whom and for...
They, on the other hand, are calling for a revolution.
You know what? No.
Because that's all it's going to do.
We should be spending
it's
our just, time.
You know, but media critic Jay Rosen says mainstream news reporters don't tell you what they think enough of the time.
I'd like to know something about their background, like where they're from, who some of their heroes and villains are, any convictions, deeply held convictions they developed by reporting on this story over a long period of time.
Rosen is an associate professor of journalism at New York University. He says there would be a real benefit to such disclosure.
We can tell where the person is coming from and apply whatever discount rate we want to what they're saying. And I also think that it's more likely to generate trust. And this is the main reason I recommend Here's Where I'm Coming From as a replacement for The View from Nowhere.
The View from Nowhere. That's the name Rosen gives to what he says is the media's true ideology, a way of falsely advertising that they can be trusted because they don't have any dog in the fight. For much of the conventional press, that is, of course, crazy talk.
I believe the Washington Post does make clear where we're coming from. Where we're coming from in our news gathering is no partisanship or ideology of any kind. We are transparent about where we're coming from, and our reporting speaks for itself. It is not coming from a point of view.
That's Leonard Downey, the Post's former executive editor and a leading advocate of impartiality in reporting. He went so far as to not vote when he was editor. Downey says true objectivity is an unrealizable goal, but that dedicated journalists working together can carry out vital watchdog reporting without carrying a brief for any particular side. It's that impartiality that allows readers to trust his paper, Downey says.
I would be very disturbed if the Washington Post tomorrow became an avowedly conservative or avowedly liberal newspaper. But you make it seem like all we have to do is admit that's what we already are, when in fact it would mean changing what we are.
So, for example, NBC News suspended opinion hosts Keith Olbermann and Joe Scarborough for failing to get approval to make contributions to political candidates. And NPR terminated the contract of former news analyst Juan Williams for repeatedly voicing personal views. Downey and Rosen agree on one thing. The principle of impartiality is an accident of economics. A century ago, there were several newspapers in every big city, and each allied to a political faction. But as papers died off, the surviving dailies sought to strip blatant opinion out of their news pages to appeal to a wider audience. But those values are under siege. Rosen points to the decision of Peter S. Goodman to leave his job as national economics correspondent for the New York Times to become business editor at the liberal Huffington Post. Goodman says he's less sure his shift represents anything so grand.
I mean, this is not about ranting. It's not about getting individuals elected. It's about the same mission that I think has been part of quality journalism forever, which is uncovering truths that aren't always so easy to uncover.
Then again, Goodman says his reporters will have some liberties, others might not.
I don't want them feeling like they just have to hand, these people said this and those people said that. Here, dear reader, you figure it out. I would like them engaged in a process of getting to a satisfying conclusion.
Conservatives have complained for years about what they see as a pervasive liberal sensibility in the media. This is different. Rosen says that view from nowhere too often limits political reporters to obsessing about winners and losers, who's up or down, rather than the harder work of determining who's telling the truth or the effects of the policies those politicians adopt.
Removing all bias from their reports is something professional journalists actually aren't very good at. And they shouldn't say that they can do this, because it's very clear to most of the people on the receiving end that they fail at this all the time.
Jay Rosen argues that journalists will rebuild trust only if they reveal their beliefs, not suppress them. David Folkenflik, NPR News.